Welcome to this week's episode of The Read Out Loud, a weekly biotech podcast from STAT. I'm Damian Garde.
I'm Adam Feuerstein.
And I'm Rebecca Robbins.
Adam and I are coming to you from STAT's worldwide headquarters here in Boston.
And I'm recording from STAT's San Francisco outpost.
It's Thursday, August 2nd, and here's what's on the docket this week.
Startups working on cell and gene therapy have a problem. There simply aren't enough manufacturing experts for them to hire. We'll talk about the increasingly desperate battle for talent in this space.
Times are tough for big pharma, what with drugs coming off patent and the simple reality that it's hard to grow when you're already huge. We talked to the top scientists at Sanofi about how that company plans to make up lost ground with new drugs.
We're going to take a detour from biotech and talk about what it's like to climb Mount Everest with someone who just did it. Veteran biotech journalist Luke Timmerman joins us to talk about life at 29,000 feet.
And finally, we'll bring you a lightning round, jam-packed with hot takes on earnings season, an interestingly timed departure from Moderna Therapeutics, and a decision on what will likely be the first approved drug using snippets of genetic code to shut down disease-causing genes.
Last week, Sarepta Therapeutics had to put on hold its clinical trial for a gene therapy to treat Duchenne muscular dystrophy.
The problem was some of the materials used in that treatment weren't the way they should be. The company was doing a routine quality assurance test and discovered basically that a batch of the gene therapy was amiss.
Now, the incident is a reminder of just how important the manufacturing process is in the development of these cutting-edge therapies, and how important it is to have someone who knows what they're doing, technically speaking, running the show.
And so that brings up sort of an emerging dilemma in cell and gene therapy and other sort of high-tech biotech treatments. Investors are pouring money into these startups because it all seems so promising, but all the money in the world isn't helping these companies solve a crucial problem, which is that there aren't enough people to go around who are qualified to fill the jobs like chief technical officer or senior vice president of manufacturing that are essential to make sure this stuff works.
Rebecca, you just wrote a story about this phenomenon. So what's going on here?
Yeah, so Nina Shelson, a biopharma VC at Canaan Partners, who you may recall is a recent guest on this podcast, put it best when I interviewed her. She said, "You can count manufacturing experts in cell and gene therapy on one or two hands." So among these experts, a few are being held onto for dear life by companies like Novartis, Kite Gilead, and Juno Celgene, the leaders in the space. And a couple of the other experts are on the beach somewhere because they did so well in some of this recent M&A. And so this talent shortage is becoming a big problem for companies in the space because, as we discussed, this job is so important. And these companies are getting desperate to try to poach the few experts that are out there.
So why are these experts so important? What do they do exactly that's so key to these treatments?
So this is not a glamorous job. You have never seen one of these experts on TV or on stage at JP Morgan. But what they do is crucial to the operation. These people tend to have several decades of experience managing big teams, working on process development, site quality, everything that goes into manufacturing of biologic drugs. And these experts bring a deep understanding of how, say, a T cell will behave during manufacturing. They know how to recognize when something's going to go wrong, and they also have the know-how to fix anomalies during the run and still wind up with a successful batch.
Rebecca, what kind of salaries are these jobs commanding?
So it definitely ranges, but one figure I heard was the ballpark from $260K to $400K. So this is someone accepting a job as a vice president or a C-suite executive with a position like chief technical officer. So you might see a small biotech startup on the lower end of that range, while a large pharma company can afford to fall on the higher end of their range. And it's worth noting that that's a base salary. It doesn't include the additional elements of the compensation, things like equity and performance bonus, which can be part of the package and really drive up the value. And I think what I heard doing interviews for this story is that these experts are in such high demand that they can command whatever salary they want.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned there's this war for talent. I'm curious, what was the craziest story you heard about the lengths that a company was willing to go to try to poach or win over some job candidate?
So plenty of these experts are getting hounded by headhunters on LinkedIn, sometimes more than once a week. But one story really stood out. This was from a manufacturing expert who's been working in cell and gene therapy for 3 decades. So he's one of these sort of elite in high demand experts. And one company that wanted to recruit him was so desperate that first they offered him the chance to name his own salary. Then they offered him the chance to name what equity stake he wanted in the company. And when those offers didn't work, the chairman of the board at this company tried to pitch him a deal, which is he would buy this expert a $10,000 Omega Speedmaster wristwatch in exchange for this expert agreeing to join the company.
And for any headhunters listening, I would be willing to change jobs for, like, a Timex. So it's a weird time to be a big pharma. Many of the world's largest drug makers are struggling to grow. They're saddled with aging products and watching smaller companies outpace them when it comes to cutting-edge science.
Sanofi, the roughly $100 billion French giant, is in a similar situation. Sales were down last quarter, and Wall Street isn't especially enthusiastic about the future.
Dr. Gary Nabel, who's Sanofi's chief science officer, came to the Stat Newsroom this week for a long conversation about the company's plans to catch up to its competitors. And we've cut and chopped a few highlights from the conversation to present to you.
So it's no secret that Sanofi missed out on the first wave of drugs that use the immune system to fight cancer. Today, the so-called immuno-oncology treatment market is dominated by 2 checkpoint inhibitors from Merck and Bristol-Myers Squibb. Roche and AstraZeneca each take a smaller share with their own checkpoint inhibitors.
And bringing up the rear somewhat distantly is Sanofi, and they, with partner Regeneron, have a checkpoint inhibitor of their own. That drug is called cemiplimab, and it's currently under FDA review with a decision date expected in October. Here's what Gary Nabel had to say about Sanofi's plans to make up all that lost ground in immuno-oncology.
I would say we have a multi-pronged strategy. One is to sort of get back into the game with the tools that you kind of need to play. And that includes, you know, checkpoint inhibitors. You probably saw the paper on cemiplimab that we had with Regeneron. We're partnering with Regeneron. So I was actually part of the team that put together that plan for that joint venture 2 or 3 years ago. So we have a whole set of assets that we're developing together with them. And the whole idea behind that was to sort of quickly catch up with the basics, but position ourselves for combinations. And so you're seeing that already. We have combination studies of PD-1 with anti-CD38. There'll be others that are coming down the pike. Our investment in the cancer immunotherapy area is probably over $2 billion in the last 3 years or so. I see some really exciting products in the pipeline. It's still early, you're right, we missed the first wave, but it's a long game. And I'm really encouraged by the direction that we're going in, and I think the clinical trials will start to unfold. And I think we'll definitely get back in the game.
As we mentioned, that drug was invented by Regeneron. So too were Sanofi's recently approved drugs for rheumatoid arthritis and severe eczema. For about 10 years, the two companies worked together in one of the industry's most successful partnerships. And then last year, they decided to go their separate ways. So we asked Gary Nabel, how is Sanofi going to fill that gap?
First, let me say we love Regeneron. I think they're very hardworking, creative, and critical in terms of what they do. We also, I think, do contribute a lot to the development. And particularly, what's been nice about the collaboration is that we each bring strengths to what we're doing. Going forward, I don't necessarily think that we're just going to part and never talk to each other. I mean, clearly we have products together, and so we'll continue to work together on the established products. You know, in terms of the monoclonal antibody technology, as great as Regeneron is, there are a lot of different ways to make human antibodies now. And we can do that in-house. And also, we now have technologies that even Regeneron doesn't have, like the trispecific.
And in the interest of clarity, when he said trispecific, what he means is an antibody that can hit three targets at the same time, thus being trispecific. Anyway, finally, we asked Nabil whether there's a cultural divide between Sanofi's operation in Boston, which is where he works, and its home base in Paris. And he had an interesting anecdote to offer.
Probably about 3 years ago, we had a young politician visit us in the Genzyme Center by the name of Emmanuel Macron. And he gets it. I guarantee you, he gets it. He had some very interesting insights, actually. He says, you know, the biggest problem we have in France is not that we don't have the money to invest, but the problem is that for us, it's the cost to fail is too high. If we start up a business and the business fails, we can't shut it down. We can't declare bankruptcy. And so think about it. If you're a VC, you're not going to invest there. And or even if you do, if it comes time to get out, you know, it's like programs sell death. You have to make room for new ventures.
Only a few thousand people have ever reached the highest point in the world, the summit of Mount Everest.
A new member of that club is veteran biotech journalist Luke Timmerman, who reached the summit in May, and he's here today to tell us about it.
Luke covers biotech news on his subscription site called The Timmerman Report. You can also follow him on Twitter at Luke Timmerman. Luke, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
So, Luke, you know, I was looking back in my email, and it was actually August of last year where you sent me an email telling me, hey, I have this crazy idea of climbing Mount Everest, and you did it. So congratulations, and maybe you can like recap the trip for us, you know, how long you were gone, you know, and how long you spent actually ascending the mountain.
So the trip takes about 2 months. So I was basically gone all of April and May in Nepal. That is the amount of time it takes to acclimate, to get your body to adjust to the higher elevations so that you can produce enough red blood cells that carry the oxygen you need up high.
So what was the hardest part of the climb as a whole?
You know, the mental part was really tough. I had trained really hard to be ready physically, but a two-month expedition with lots of up and down. So you go up the mountain on acclimatization runs, and then you retreat back to base camp to recover your strength. And then you go up again to test your body a little further, and then you come back down again. It's a little bit of a seesaw kind of effect, and there's a lot of waiting. You have to stay patient and focused in order to get through an expedition that's that long and that difficult.
And was there ever a moment when, either mentally or physically, you had any doubts about your ability to finish the climb?
Oh, yeah, I did, up at the Camp 2. So this would have been about 21,500 feet. Camping there is a challenge. So all of your systems are under stress. The respiratory, the circulatory, the digestive, your psychological system, if you want to. and so it was hard for me to sleep. I'd wake up multiple times at night kind of gasping for breath. And then that kind of gets in your head, right? You start thinking, gosh, if I'm not sleeping, how am I possibly going to get through the next day? That's where I tried to turn to some positive thinking to get through that. And it turned out I was able to get along just fine.
One of the goals of your trip was to raise money for cancer research. How much money did you raise, and where is that money going?
Yeah, so I raised $339,000 for the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center here in Seattle, where I'm based. And as you know, I mean, it's one of the top handful of immunotherapy centers. The actual proceeds from the climb go just to basic cancer research. And I'm really, really excited. I'm thrilled that it raised that much money and engaged that many people around the country in what I think of as a really promising field at a very exciting time.
So just getting back to the climb real quick, when you Google how tall is Mount Everest, the answer is apparently 29,029 feet. And I'm curious, like, could you describe for us what those last 29 feet look like and how you felt right at the end there taking those last steps?
Well, the last 29 feet, it's a little anticlimactic. So actually, on our summit day, the sun started coming up right around what's called the South Summit. And this is a few hundred feet below the true summit. But once you get there, you have an actual point where you can take a break, get a drink of water, wiggle your toes if you need to warm them up like I did. And you can see that the end is in sight. It's maybe an hour worth of climbing. And it's not that steep, the last few hundred feet. That was the moment for me when it really kind of hit me that, wow, this is actually happening. It's there. That was a pretty exciting moment.
All right, so Luke, I'm going to ask you the question that everybody wants to ask you, but nobody dares to, so I'll do it. Tell us what it's like going to the bathroom at, 28, 29,000 feet.
You try not to up there at that height. I don't know if you want this in the show, but there
were...
Oh,
we do, Luke. We want it in the show. Don't worry.
There were members of my team that loaded up on Imodium to try to plug up the digestive system so that they would not have to strip down the goose down suit and take a dump that high.
So, Luke, on a different note, what was the first thing you ate when you got back home to Seattle?
There has been a fair bit of beer and pizza. I did lose some weight, and I felt like I was just still hungry all the time. I actually have stopped by. There's a Himalayan Sherpa restaurant not too far from my house, and it's funny because I went there maybe once before, but when I go there now, it feels kind of like home.
So speaking of your surrogate home, are you planning to climb Everest again now?
I don't think I'll do Everest again. That was a one-time deal. I'm still thinking about what I might want to do next.
Well, Luke, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here on the show. Thanks, guys.
All right, now let's do my favorite segment of this podcast, the lightning round.
Sponsored this week by our recently departed executive producer, Jeff Del Vizio.
So for starters, we're coming to the tail end of an earnings season. And going into it, and we've talked about this on this podcast, there's all this consternation about the quote-unquote four horsemen of biotech in Amgen, Biogen, Celgene, and Gilead Sciences. But Adam, the four horsemen are back.
My hot take is that earnings are great.
And you're not alone in that sentiment. Each of the companies we mentioned outperformed what people expected for the second quarter. And while it's just a single data point, there had been so much malaise going into it that it can't not be good news, despite, me trying to pick it apart as such.
Another thing worth noting from earnings season, Pfizer CEO Ian Reed made an interesting comment during his company's earnings call. He predicted that the controversial rebates the drug makers pay to pharmacy benefit managers are on their way out.
Yeah, specifically Reed said, quote, "I believe we are going to go to a marketplace where we don't have rebates." So Damian, what exactly does that mean?
Well, not to, interrupt the lightning because this is supposed to be fast, but as you may know, the system of drug pricing in this country is incredibly complex. And part of that is because there is a list price, which is publicly known. And then there is a price that people actually pay, which is affected by these rebates that drug companies offer to middlemen. There's this whole fight over who's to blame for drug costs going up, but the drug industry's line, is that these middlemen, via these rebates, are bilking the system. So if Ian Reed is correct, and he has seemingly the support of the Trump administration in this, those rebates might go away, which would be definitely good for drug makers, and maybe we'll see good for actual patients.
And it's also worth noting a comment made by for the Financial Times' David Crow this week, who said that even if you got rid of the middlemen and all that profit that they make from these rebates, the issue of high drug prices is still there and is not going away.
All right, let's talk about biotech's favorite unicorn, Moderna Therapeutics. Damian, we haven't heard from Moderna lately. What's up with them?
So the latest thing, and if you don't recall, Moderna is a company that has a roughly $8 billion valuation now, despite being in the fairly early stages of developing drugs. And they have deeply embraced oncology. And what we learned this week is that the guy they appointed to lead their oncology effort is leaving the company. And that comes as a string, or as part of a string, of sort of high-profile departures from Moderna that kind of runs counter to the company's narrative, which is that they're doing very promising science that will be very lucrative in the long term and thus defend that valuation, and yet the people tasked with doing that science tend to leave. We are actually only about a calendar year removed from the last head of oncology leaving Moderna.
Next up in the lightning round, Hong Kong IPOs.
So as you may recall, the stock market there recently changed its rules to allow biotechs that have yet to generate any revenue to list there. The fear was that that could lead to some volatility and leave investors in trouble.
And that's arguably exactly what happened with the first one. A company called Asclepius Pharma, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, went public this week. On day one, the stock was up and down, but then closed flat. And then on day two, the bottom kind of fell out and the company closed down 15%. So if you bought into the IPO, you're now holding the bag a little bit.
Yeah. And the other thing that we've noted in the past about the Hong Kong biotech IPO market is that a lot of money was going to be raised in China. And I think we saw that with the second deal that came through from a company called BeiGene, which raised, what, something like $900 million in a secondary offering this week.
So these are just two data points, and we might not want to draw sweeping conclusions based on these examples, but I think it's fair to say that these first two IPOs don't bode very well. I think the underwriters managed to support the Asclepius IPO at first, but now that it's been exposed to the market, investors seem to think it was overvalued from the start, and that doesn't seem like a good sign.
Finally, looking ahead to next week, we are watching for a groundbreaking FDA decision in that a drug from Alnylam Pharmaceuticals is expected to win regulatory approval.
Right. And that would be the first commercial product based on RNA interference, or more commonly known as RNAi.
So that technology relies on snippets of genetic code to shut down genes that cause disease. And Alnylam wants to use it to treat a rare nerve disorder.
And so the FDA has promised to make a decision by a week from Saturday, which is August 11th. And this will be kind of a big deal. Alnylam has been working on RNAi for more than a decade. It's a discovery that won a Nobel Prize, but as is often true in drug development, there were many peaks and valleys along the way. So this would be not necessarily the closure of a saga. I'm sure Alnylam would describe it as the beginning of something, but it would mark a major milestone for that science.
Good luck, Alnylam. That does it for another episode of The Read Out Loud.
We want to thank Hyacinth Empanado and Alex Hogan, who produced this week's episode and made us sound better than we are.
Matthew Orr is our senior producer, and Rick Burke is our executive producer.
And as always, we would love to hear from you. Your comments on the episode, your suggestions for future topics, your gripes about all the things that we do incorrectly, you can send us an email at readoutloud@statnews.com.
And before we go, we want to wish Adam good luck on the Pan Mass Challenge bike ride. He's going to be riding 85 miles on Saturday to raise money for cancer research.
Thanks, Rebecca.
See you next week.